In the aftermath of the attack on Valoris, the Inner Circle travels to Highburn to execute their plan to nullify the Cauldron. But things do not go as planned, bringing to fruition the greatest of Feyre and Rhys's nightmares. With Rhys's friends near death while he is powerless, and Feyre's sisters now made immortal like her, Feyre takes on the burden of sacrifice once again. The two play one last game to fool the King of Highburn and Tamlin to aid their friend's escape, and allow Feyre to infiltrate the Spring Court. Not as Tamlin's lover, as she would have them believe, but as High Lady of the Night Court.
The views expressed by the hosts are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author. This podcast is a discussion shared to spark thought and conversation on the characters and themes of this novel.
Though the hosts speak mostly within the constraints of this book, series spoilers may be discussed with or without warning. Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, self-harm, and depression will recur throughout this podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a podcast where we deep dive into the writing of your favorite novels.
This season, we are exploring Sarah J. Maas's most beloved novel in the Court of Thorns and Roses series.
This is Jack.
And I'm Amy.
This week, we're discussing chapters 61 through 69 in A Court of Mist and Fury.
In this final episode of this season, we ask ourselves, what does accountability look like for the characters at the end of this novel?
Themes we're going to see this episode include consequences of actions, as well as personal failures. And later on, at the end of this episode, we're going to cover questions that we asked at the beginning of the season.
We begin our finale in chapter 61. This scene is a beautiful juxtaposition from the opening scene in chapter 2 of this book. Let's go through the threads that tie them together. Feyre begins by being outfitted with many, many weapons. This is a direct contrast to the one jeweled hunting knife and matching belt Feyre was allowed to carry at the start. Unlike the Spring Court, where she was adorned with fine jewelry she hated, Feyre is adorned with all the weapons she once considered to be her fine jewelry here in the Night Court.
Feyre says, quote, "I never worn so much steel. Blades had been strapped all over me, hidden in my boots, my inside pockets, and then there was the Illyrian blade down my back." Feyre doesn't say she's never worn so many weapons, but rather she says steel. She stripped the weapon down to its bare foundation, what they're made of. In many ways, we could see Feyre doing this to herself. Remember, Feyre is now High Lady, a title that she's completely embraced. For the first time, it's a title that was freely given and freely received. Every move Feyre is about to make, every thought, is now from the High Lady. Also, think about the fact that she's wearing Illyrian blades. We're going to come back to that in a bit.
Feyre is preparing to go with the Inner Circle to infiltrate Highburn's castle to break or steal the cauldron. This is a radical difference when compared to the fact that Tamlin and Lucien were going out to investigate reports at the start of the novel that they wouldn't allow Feyre to join. Though Rhysand may have just as much of a desire as Tamlin to keep Feyre safe, instead of cloistering her at home, Rhys makes Cassian and Azriel swear on their life to protect Feyre. I'm not sure Lucien would be willing to do that.
I just love how much we're going to shit on Lucien this episode.
I actually think we don't shit on him as much as we have this whole season.
It's a nice little comeback for him.
Yeah.
He makes like a nice revival.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. Another great comparison from the beginning of the book to now is the fact that Feyre has the spell written clearly and she needs to read it. Feyre is not nervous about her ability to read, and it's not even something she thinks about. For me, it's really easy to forget that at the start of the book, Feyre didn't know how to read. Really, if you think about Feyre and just the entire story from the start of the book to Feyre and where we are now, sometimes it feels like I'm looking back to an entirely different book. But that's SJM showing us that she knows exactly what she's doing, because the character development has, I don't even want to say, it's not like a 180, a 360. It's like a squiggly line all the way across somewhere else.
Yeah, she's had a completely different trajectory compared to the Feyre at the start.
Thinking about early book doesn't even exist to me.
No.
When you're at the end of this book.
Completely different universe.
Yeah, I respect that a lot.
Yes, agreed. Because it's believable.
Oh, yeah. Like, you blink and you're gone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was never a moment of, like, how are we here? It just all made sense. Mm-hmm. And then when you look back, turns out we've walked 1,000 miles of reading.
The Book of Breathings accompanies the group, and it whispers to Feyre, calling her names that feel contradictory, like lovely, wicked liar, that sound both sexual, like a name Rhys may have called Feyre in the cabin, as well as mocking. Though Feyre has come a long way since the beginning of the book, we are more comfortable with these warring sides of Feyre, and she has found balance amidst them as well.
It's in total stark contrast to when Feyre was calling herself a liar and a traitor. The book is calling her these things, and it's one of those moments where it's like, you can't call me anything worse than I've already called myself. Feyre doesn't actually take what the book says to her personally.
And it doesn't spark self-hatred for her anymore.
Yeah.
Whatever the book is calling her, she doesn't feel these things to be true, where once she did.
Yeah, like it was almost like, it knows its secret. It knows my secret. It knows I lied.
Right.
And it's just like, calling me a lovely, wicked liar? Damn right.
Yeah, exactly.
Talk dirty
to me.
The book starts to get uncomfortable. It's like, you weren't supposed to have this reaction. Before the Inner Circle leaves to Highburn, we get a rare moment of the High Lord and his subjects. Cassian says, quote, with my life, High Lord, I'll protect her with my life. And this formality brings comfort to Rhys after Cassian and Azriel both agree to protect Feyre with their life. This setting is a new example for Feyre. It's the comfort and ease of being in a position of power. Rhys doesn't have to prove a point to Cassian and Az to show that he's their High Lord. Instead, he's sitting back and welcoming what is offered, and that's more powerful in some ways.
What's worth noting as well in this scene is that Mor mentions knowing her orders when Rhys looks at her. And Feyre acknowledges that Feyre doesn't know those orders, and she wonders why she hasn't been told them, but doesn't get mad. I think this may be something Feyre would have reacted differently to had she not come so far and begun to trust Rhys so inherently.
I also think that becoming High Lady has helped too. It's like in these few hours Feyre's been High Lady, she understands that knowledge will come and she doesn't need to prove herself as powerful. We can pretty much guess what Rhys made Mor promise, like get the hell out of there at all costs. But honestly, I was expecting something kind of bigger and crazier because it just seemed, you know, like so mysterious, like Mor. You remember what you said.
Yeah, I wish Mor had pulled out like a secret move or something.
Yeah, I don't know. But I also want to be that mysterious now, like with you, Amy. Be like, Amy, you remember what I said earlier. And then just walk away.
And I'll be like, you said a lot of things. I don't know which one you mean.
I know. Well, I'm like, our friends lean over to you and they're like, what'd she say? It's like, she really wants to eat sushi again tonight. I don't know.
Probably. It's probably what it would be. When the group winnow to Highburn, Feyre begins to freefall until Cassian catches her. It's nice to see him keeping his word to Rhys, but to me, it also shows how he's there for Feyre as a friend, unlike some High Fae with red hair.
Yeah, fuck you, Lucian. Until the next book, when we get into Mor of Lucian's character development and we get to analyze him Mor, we'll probably have a little bit Mor sympathy for Lucian. Until then, you're just going to have to wait for season 3 coming out in 2023, guys, where we will discuss A Court of Wing and Ruin.
The image of Highburn is a foreboding one. While it's meant to cause a sense of foreboding, I think that readers naturally hope and expect a happy ending, especially given the success of defending Valoris. I'll try to point out the clues that Sarah J. Maas drops to foreshadow otherwise. The landmass of Highburn is compared to, quote, a spider that had been waiting in its web for a long, long time. I mean, come on, this clearly says, it's a trap!
Also, who else did Feyre describe as spiders? The queens. And who's there? The queens.
Great point.
Great job, Sarah.
Yeah, seriously. The Book of Breathings whispers, quote, home, take me home. In some ways, this is a sentiment that Feyre can understand. She doesn't recoil at the thought, but acknowledges she can feel the pull of the cauldron. Feyre will be easily influenced by this cauldron, falling into its snare and do exactly what Amryn told her not to do.
The book keeps calling to be home with the cauldron. We get this several times over the next few chapters. We said at the beginning of this season that home was going to be a big theme in this book, with Feyre discovering her own home. I think the book is mocking that. And I'm not saying that the book is specifically mocking her, just that the book having the same sentiment as Feyre tarnishes the otherwise pure desire. I don't think that this messes with Feyre, though. If anything, it's a reminder that she has a home. Quote, they sent that legion to wreck and butcher my city. She calls Valoris her city because it is. It's both her home and she literally owns it. She's the High Lady.
Yes. You were correct. But we don't know that as readers if we're reading for the first time.
No, but Vera's never had an ownership claim.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she really eases into her role as High Lady very quickly.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. She's very comfortable with it.
Yeah.
As they infiltrate the castle, Vera observes there are no guards on the towers, which Cassian explains is because of a change in guard shift. Vera also remarks that, quote, there was no one in the dungeon. They, Cassian and Asriel, had executed this masterfully. We have such utter faith in the Illyrians, as does Vera, that we fall into the trap of thinking that our characters will be safe. We are reminded again of how far Vera has come with regard to her relationship with violence in this place. Asriel comes back from killing the first set of guards, and Vera observes that, quote, there was blood on his knife, an ash knife.
Yeah, Farrah's over here thinking like, yeah, I remember my first time I killed someone with a ash arrow, like a seasoned warrior or something. Suddenly she doesn't care about it and she's all NBD. And even us as readers, if we think back to the book one, like as readers, we were clutching our pearls because Farrah had to kill three Fae. Meanwhile, Daddy Azzy is out here racking up a body count and we're lusting after him, hoping that this murder body count matches his other body count. Sex.
Oh, I see.
I don't know. You weren't making eye contact with me.
No, I get it now. I get it now. I was trying to decipher and understand.
Sex.
Sex. Always.
Always. We're screwed talking about Asriel next season.
Oh, yeah, we are.
Whew.
Every time Cassian and Asriel kill more of the guards, Feyre thinks, quote, it might all be for nothing, but not these deaths. No, those I did not mind at all. We get our first description of the cauldron at the start of chapter 62. Here we see some additional clues that I think foreshadow how this whole mission is going to play out. The cauldron is described in contrasts, just as Feyre has been throughout the novel, suggesting once again her affinity for it. Quote, the cauldron was absence and presence. I had never seen something so hideous and alluring.
I find it interesting that Feyre and the cauldron have so much in common, because she's not made from it. Her sisters are. They will end up having a connection with the cauldron that's different. But I think what we're experiencing here is almost a spiritual connection. The characters in this book never reference a god. Instead, what we hear them talk about is the cauldron and the mother. In book one, Feyre doesn't even believe in the cauldron, and now here she is right in front of it, and they're one and the same.
That's a really good point, that Feyre isn't made by the cauldron, but she is made, and the cauldron was made, in theory.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about eventually... And at this point, spoiler for Wing and Ruin, but Nesta and Elaine are the cauldron,
mm-hmm.
like, or they're from the cauldron.
Mm-hmm.
The sentiment is almost like the cauldron knows that it owns them. It owns a piece of them. So they're not equal.
Right.
I feel like the cauldron views Feyre almost like an equal.
Yeah, I feel like Feyre is a sibling, where mm-hmm. Nesta and Elaine are its children, almost.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, bring me back what you took from me.
Right.
Versus Feyre, it's like, oh, hi.
Oh, hi. I see you.
Hey, girl. What are you doing? Do you want to grab some lunch later?
The cauldron is also described as being the size of a bathtub. On one hand, this may just be Sarah J. Maas helping us visualize the size of it. However, Feyre has also had a strong affinity for bathtubs throughout this novel. You can't tell me that in making this comparison, Feyre isn't tempted to see if she can fit in it, because I would be.
Oh, yeah. Like, whenever I see a bathtub, I always wonder if it's going to cover my boobs. Like, yeah. If I lay down, do my boobs and my legs all submerge?
Right. Exactly.
The answer is never has it happened.
Yeah. Unless it's a jacuzzi.
Yeah. Yeah. I eye tubs all the time for the same reason as Feyre. Feyre certainly loves her tubs. What I think this is, though, is that we've compared bathing in this book to baptisms. And now here's Feyre with the closest thing that the Fae have to a religion, and of course she would see an oversized bathtub because this is almost a religious experience. Additionally, Feyre's sisters are about to go in there and be remade, be baptized by the cauldron.
Such a great point.
Ooh, that means Feyre is the mother, if they're equal.
Could be.
I don't know, but I kind of like it.
I like it too.
Yeah. I'm not saying that that's my actual theory, just like the metaphor of it all.
Mm-hmm. The atmosphere becomes almost sexual in this moment. There is, quote, a throbbing, like blood pulsed through the room. Though Sarah J. Maas is conveying that the cauldron is alive, these verbs are the same verbs she used in other highly sexual situations, a.k.a. the Court of Nightmares.
When Feyre touches the cauldron, she says, quote, pain, pain and ecstasy and power and weakness flowed into me.
Sexy.
Sexy.
It is very quickly after this that we see how the cauldron's influence over Feyre unfolds. The Book of Breathings speaks to both sides of Feyre. One half calls her, quote, sweet-tongued liar, lady of many faces, princess of Carrion, while the other half calls her lovely girl, beautiful bird, so sweet, so generous. Just as Feyre has brought her two sides, her dark and light, together, so too is she convinced to bring these two halves together.
Feyre fails very quickly here. And I understand that's how plot works. We can't have Feyre standing there forever thinking that she's going to be able to actually succeed. We want the story to keep going. But oh my God, like Feyre failed with being a human emissary and now she can't keep the books away from each other for all of 5 minutes. It's kind of like, damn, Feyre, I could have tried a little bit harder. Love her though. While Feyre is getting close to mastering the book, she says, quote, I slogged forward into myself, into who I was. Strong hands tugged me back, wrenching me away. Okay, so what I'm wondering here is, was Feyre heading towards an actual power, a piece of her inner self that maybe had even more power than she realized? Considering the fact that she was just pulled away from that power, is that something that we feel like we're going to come back to eventually?
So how I read this is that as Feyre communes with the cauldron and the Book of Breathings, she almost goes into a trance-like state.
Yeah.
And it takes over her willpower. Mm-hmm. And she's slogging towards her will and her power, trying to not be manipulated, but she can't overcome it.
She would have gotten there.
She would have gotten there, but she ultimately ended up putting the Book of Breathings together.
The part where I'm reading was after the Book of Breathings were together.
Right. And that she's trying to come back to herself.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's an interesting moment where she's like about to get hold of herself.
Yeah. I wonder if she could have spoken the words at that point if she hadn't been interrupted.
Yeah. I mean, that's what she's like reaching towards are those words. And she, I think she could have.
I think she could have. I just don't think she had the time.
Because no one was willing to like have her back, fight it out.
Yeah. Fair.
Block her.
So in what ways do they not fully trust her abilities yet?
In all the ways, completely, every single way.
I think it's Azrael too, right?
Yeah.
Come on, Az.
Come on. I'm going to say because like Mar told him to. No.
Sure. It's... I bet everybody just panicked.
I mean, absolutely. Like everyone promised Rhys that they're going to save her with their life. And at this point, her nose is bleeding and she's in this trance. So everyone's going to stop her. But, you know, I feel like Amryn would have let it go on a bit more.
Yeah, probably. At the start of chapter 63, Jurien enters the scene and we get our first glimpse of the man who was once just an eye on Amarantha's finger. When it is discovered that the King of Hybern has spun a spell that traps the crew in the dungeon, Jurien smiles at them in a way Feyre describes as lupine, which means wolf-like. Jurien has become the predator here, a resurrected human. Feyre was most recently a wolf, yet in the face of Jurien, he's taken that title.
The King of Hybern joins the group shortly thereafter. Let's talk about the description of him. Quote, the shoulder-length black hair, ruddy skin, the clothes that edged more towards practicality than finery. He was a surprisingly average height, but muscled like a young man. But his face, which looked perhaps like a human man in his 40s, blandly handsome, to hide the depthless, hateful black eyes that burned there. What does this remind us of? I'm reminded of Feyre's first description of Amryn and Amarantha. What did those two things have in common? Well, Feyre does not find individuals she deem as powerful and intimidating to be attractive. They are often called plain or inferred to be as ugly. The same thing is happening here.
It's actually an interesting choice on Sarah's part to have such a boring looking character as the big bad. I know when I got to this part for the first time, I definitely expected a more attractive man.
Yeah.
Or more intimidating, or more dark and tall and big and broody. So to what extent do we as readers take this big bad, the King of Hybern, for granted and believe our protagonists will win the day because of the way he's described?
Well, first, maybe Hybern just has ugly people.
Fair.
Just an ugly continent or ugly island.
Could be.
It could be. Second, I'm trying to remember what it was like to read this the first time. I think we all know that nothing good is going to come of it. You know, like, I think as we're all reading this, we're just like, there are not many pages left. How is this one going to end?
Right.
I'm going to say that a character's unattractiveness makes a person feel ill at ease. Therefore, I think we end up taking them more seriously as an antagonist. And then therefore we think that like, oh, they actually might stand a chance because they're not like this beautiful being. We're uncomfortable. He's like a middle-aged guy and who's not attractive. Ugh, no, thank you. Evil.
But he's blandly handsome. So it's not that he's ugly. When yeah. I think of a bad guy, I think of someone really disformed.
Who would you cast for blandly handsome?
The prince from Ever After.
Oh, good job with Drew Barrymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you're looking at them and.
But he's not sinister.
Yeah. Like technically you're handsome, but also gross.
Yeah. And that's the thing is when I think of the epitome of evil, right? Because mm-hmm. Highburn comes across as the epitome of evil.
Yeah.
I think Voldemort.
Yeah, that's fair.
I think someone who is just like truly hideous. And that's not who this is.
It is a cool choice where it's like, he's not going to be attractive, but he's attractive, but he's not ugly.
Right.
But he's not. Yeah. It's the description blandly handsome. I did get caught on it because I'm like, what does that even look like?
Mm-hmm.
Those are two words you would never imagine together. And just all of it. I think all of it's just meant to make us feel uncomfortable. Like, are you hot? Are you not? What?
Yeah.
Eh.
Average height. I might be taller than you. What?
No, I'm just, you're not average.
No, I'm just teasing. You might be taller than him.
I'm average. What's that? Yeah, is the average male height 5'10"?
Yeah.
So I'm 5'8".
In heels, you'd be taller than him.
Oh, I'd make Highburn my bitch. And he'd say, yes, ma'am, can I have another?
Okay, so I did my fan cast for the King of Highburn. Who would be yours?
Okay. Not because I think this actor is ugly. I just think that they could do bland well if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
George Clooney.
Mm.
He's very attractive, but I think you can ugly him up a little.
Okay.
Like, I think he knows that the salt and pepper look. Like, have you ever seen George Clooney with brown hair
yeah.
without any salt and pepper?
It's weird.
Yeah. And yeah. I think like he knows what he looks like to make him look spicy.
Yeah.
I think you can bland him up pretty quickly.
Okay. I also see like Mark Ruffalo.
I think you're better at this, is what I'm saying. Wait, isn't that one of the episodes that we're going to do in the postseason, our fan cast?
Yeah, but I just felt like we
come up with it now. Yeah, I need more time. I need more time, guys. If you want more of our fan cast, stick around for postseason content. We're going to fan cast the entire series.
The environment of the castle becomes deadly, more terrifying than the initial drop into Highburn. Everything here resembles death. The guards and courtiers, quote, smiled like we were their next meal. The castle appears like, quote, a skeleton of some mighty creature. And the throne is even made of human bones. That's just gross.
I mean, it's cool when the bone carver does it and the weaver, but I guess she doesn't really have bones. But
she's got hair. It's still gross.
It's still, I mean, no, it's gross. But yeah, like the bone carver's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Was that just me?
No, he is cool.
He is cool. He can hang.
And then Tamlin and Lucien enter the scene.
The start of chapter 64, we finally see Tamlin again. Now, this entire book, we've been thinking about him. Farrah's been thinking about him. And now, after many, many pages, we get to see him again. And he looks different. Quote, that face I had loved and hated so deeply. Tamlin's hair is shorter. His face is gaunt. And honestly, this sounds like a great way of seeing an ex after you've broken up with them, that they're struggling just a bit.
That must be satisfying.
I wouldn't know.
I'm sorry. I hope you have that one day.
I don't want to. That would require more exes.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's not.
That's fair. I was thinking more along your current exes struggling.
Some of them are struggling enough, honestly.
True.
It's like they either thrive or they're really struggling.
Yeah, that's true. We get the description of Tamlin to which I referred earlier this season in this chapter. Jack and I have spent a lot of airtime this season trying to convince you that Tamlin and Rhys are similar and connected. We see that come to life here. Not only does Tamlin wear a bandolier of knives, specifically sporting Illyrian hunting blades, his hair is also cut shorter, and I imagine it looks like Rhys's.
Oh my god, I love the idea that Tamlin's trying to mimic Rhys and even his hair is cut short.
Yeah, that's why else would he cut his hair?
He's suddenly like, hey Lucien, do you think I look good with black hair? It's just, I feel like, you know, you go through a breakup, you cut your hair, you dye it, you know, and he's like, do you think I look good? Like, what if I put some contacts in?
Yeah.
Like, hear me out. Violet.
He's a new man.
Yeah. He's like, I'm not trying to be like Rhys. Jeez. No. His is midnight black. Mine is dark black hair. On top of all of that, Tam-Tam and Farrah are also dressed alike. Just a few chapters before, while getting ready, Farrah is dressed in Illyrian fighting leathers and Illyrian weapons. I love that Tamlin and Farrah are starting to look more equal here. They're resembling one another, and what it shows me is that Farrah is on equal footing with Tamlin, and that there's no better physical way to show this than the two of them dressed alike. This is for the first time ever, if you think about it. When Tamlin met Farrah, she was a struggling child in the woods wearing clothes that were so dirty that they had to be burned. Then she was wearing dresses. Then under the mountain, she was also in scraps again. Like, she's never been a warrior. Now, she's dressed like a warrior the same way that he's dressed. The only difference is she's not a joke, and he is. Additionally, they're both two foreigners wearing the Illyrian-born clothing. They're posing as Illyrian fighters, although they're both outsiders. There's a big difference between Tamlin and Farrah, though. Farrah is now High Lady of the Illyrians, but she can also make her body change into an Illyrian body.
Tamlin has become who he thinks Rhys is in order to win Farrah back, in my point of view. Even going as far as to align with Highburn and the way Rhys served Amarantha. And, quite frankly, it's disgusting. But Tamlin can't be Rhys, because Tamlin still views Farrah as a pet and a possession. He holds out a hand and gives, quote, an order, like I was no better than a summoned dog.
Farrah will not be his animal anymore. And if anyone's going to compare Farrah to an animal, it's going to be Farrah.
That's right.
Yes.
Tamlin doesn't get the hint, though. When Tamlin mentions home, Farrah backs up so that she's closer to Rhysand, Azriel, and Cassian, an obvious indication of where she thinks her home is.
Farrah hasn't seen her ex, aka Tamlin, in months. So what does she do? She doesn't take his shit. And that is amazing. I just want to share some fun quotes here. Quote, I took a step towards Tamlin. What have you done? Another quote. I said steadily, clearly to Tamlin, I am not going anywhere with you. It's just like a fair appreciation month.
It's really setting up who her character is going to be in Wing and Ruin.
Yeah, but think about it. Like, Talon's never heard her speak to him this way.
No, it's true.
Farrah has yelled at Rhys, has like attacked Rhys, like everything. Mm-hmm. So if she ever said that to Rhys, he wouldn't be like, I've never heard these words before. But Tamlin is just, think about how thrown off he is.
Well, no wonder why he thinks that Rhys is controlling her.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, that makes sense because last he saw, she was this person who only wore dresses, didn't know how to read, and, you know, was super weak. Granted, half of it's his own making.
Right.
But now she's like, I'm literate, bitch. New shirt. I want to do some character setup for Lucien. Someone asked us in a live once if we'll ever be nice to Lucien. And honestly, we just haven't received enough content in the books to give him a better review. But in Wing and Ruin, we're going to get a whole lot more of Lucien. And SJM does some fantastic groundwork with his character here. When we see Lucien, he's the same as usual, playing personal bitch boy to Tamlin. Quote, I shook my head, Lucien refusing to meet the pleading stare I threw his way. Lucien doesn't stand up to Tamlin. He cringes, he observes, but once Elaine comes into the picture, he changes immediately and begins to unleash himself. This is all for Wing and Ruin, but for the small time that we get here, SJM does a whole lot to develop his character.
I love what you're pointing out, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a second. But first, I want to point out what you might view as a potential plot hole, because I certainly did at one point. In the chapter prior, Jurian speaks to Mor as if he knows her when he asks about Miriam. Yet here and in this chapter, the King of Highburn says Jurian was going crazy trying to learn who Rhys's friends are. But wait, wouldn't Jurian know Mor as Rhys's friend given their status in the Night Court and the fact that they're cousins?
You would think.
This, I think, is SJM planting a clue that Jurian isn't actually mad. Dun dun dun.
Yeah. I it's one of those things where I just kind of interpret it so many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. At first I was like, wait, does Jurian, like maybe he knew that Rhys had friends, but because he lied about it. So then, you know, who are his real friends? If they're not who I thought they were, oh, I guess they are. But what's much more likely is like, he just gave them a big ass clue.
Right.
Like he comes up to them and is clearly like, hey, Mor, remember you, sup bestie.
Yeah.
And then
to then the King of Highburn goes like, you finally know who they are. And yet no one picks that up.
Nope, not at all.
Not like, come on. I mean, Reese isn't in the room. No, Reese is in the room.
Reese is in the room.
All right. Disappointed in all of them then.
Yep. Feyre then does something that surprises everyone. She convinces the spell created with the cauldron to loose its hold on her. Just as the cauldron had coerced Feyre to do its bidding to put the Book of Breathings together, Feyre coerces the spell created by the cauldron to let her go. We've seen Feyre do this before because SJM has been really intentional about doing all this setup. Think of Feyre unlocking the locks in the Summer Court and using her Daemati gifts on Tarquin. This is no different.
And then we get the best scene ever where Tamlin stumbles into Reese's punch. He goes for Feyre, she disappears, and then like Reese just has it there set up. I want that. I want to see that in the Hulu series.
And it's just really written well.
Yeah.
It's enjoyable to read.
Yeah.
Then Tamlin continues to show how awful he is because the punch didn't wake him up. Instead of admitting defeat, now that Tamlin knows Reese and Feyre are mates, Tamlin blames Reese, saying, what did you do to her? Question. Is Tamlin angry because his possession isn't doing what she's told, or because Tamlin's betrayed Prithian for a woman who doesn't want him, who's mated to someone else, and he needs to double down?
I'm going to say all of the above. The question really should be, what issue does Tamlin not have? He's got a lot of issues. Reese has always been everything that Tamlin is not. And now here he is, Reese, mated to Feyre. So for Tamlin, it's like, oh my God, once again, I lose to Rhysand.
This reminds me of a post one of our listeners sent via direct message on Instagram recently, where the post basically said Tamlin and Amarantha must be mates because Amarantha was crazy about Tamlin and did this crazy curse trying to get him to fall for her. And Tamlin doesn't respect boundaries, doesn't listen to what people are saying, tries to take Feyre from her mate, and therefore they're equally matched because they just have a lot of issues.
I have a thought.
Yeah.
You know how in Thorns and Roses we say that when Reese breaks into the Spring Court and makes Tamlin beg on his knees in front of Feyre? I'm wondering two things. We say that that's the beginning of the end for Feyre respecting and loving Tamlin. What if that's the beginning of Tamlin's love and obsession for Feyre because Reese showed interest in Feyre?
Yes.
Not that Tamlin didn't care for her before.
Right.
But how much of this, how much of Tamlin's like, I need Feyre, has to do with the fact that Reese wants her?
It's true, because what happens right after Reese leaves? Tamlin goes and has sex with Feyre.
Immediately.
Trying to claim her.
Yep. Tamlin doesn't like do anything to protect Feyre under the mountain, but tries to claim her even more.
Right.
Because she's been dancing all sexy and half naked for Reese.
And he tries to marry her really fast after Under the Mountain because Reese has made a bargain with her.
And the more and more that Feyre leaves to go be with Reese for every month, it's not so much. And again, I'm not saying that Tamlin doesn't care for Feyre, but it's like the obsession comes from his obsession with Reese.
Yeah, I could see it.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned earlier, Tamlin continues to be in denial about Feyre's true feelings. When Feyre threatens to destroy Tamlin's court, he simply says, quote, you don't know what you're talking about. If Tamlin had stopped treating Feyre like a child, he might have saved himself a lot of future pain.
Mm-hmm. We talked personally, you and I, Amy, about defining a breakup of what happens when we break up with someone and we have a certain narrative on what happened and why. Tamlin has been living the lie of what his breakup with Feyre was like, because in his mind, they didn't actually break up. She was in love with him and she was taken, and he can't have that narrative be threatened.
No, because then why the hell did he just do what he did?
Right?
For the first time in this novel, Feyre is addressed as Feyre Archeron by the King of Highburn specifically. Feyre rejected this name because of its association with her father and being made to hunt for her family. So to be called by her family name demeans Feyre, makes Feyre human and small again, but also foreshadows what happens next. Feyre's sisters appear in the throne room. By being called her family name, Feyre is reminded of her familial connection, making what happens to her sisters probably even harder to bear.
It's also important because it's the King of Highburn who's calling Farrah by her human name. No one has called her Farrah Archeron up until this point because, well, Farrah's not human. She's not an Archeron anymore. She's Farrah Cursebreaker, or Farrah Lying Traitorous Filth, as she likes to call herself. But now the king is calling her Farrah Archeron because he's reminding her that she was human. She is weak.
And she feels that right now.
Because she is. In this moment. Not like in general, yeah. But you know.
Chapter 65 brings about a lot of revelations and surprises. We learn about Jurien's involvement with the queens and how he convinced the queens to mistrust the Night Court. We also learn about Ianthe's ties to Highburn. I think we all might have been shooketh at that point.
We were shooketh, but not surpriseth.
That's right.
Right?
Right.
It was kind of like, ooh, but you know, also, that made sense. Yeah, you know what I mean?
It's on brand.
Yeah.
Feyre threatens to slaughter if her sisters are not let go. I don't think that's the smartest move on Feyre's part to threaten the queens. But, you know, that's what we call growth. True love equals extreme violence. And of course it would, because all Feyre's done is to ensure her sisters live safe, happy lives.
This is a great moment of seeing that Feyre still has a lot to learn from Rhys. Rhys doesn't threaten. He tries to stay calm and he bargains. Feyre is reacting. And I'm sure in Wing and Ruin, like I know for sure, we're going to see her channel Rhys more. I'm going to get this next point out of the way because I know there will be people who bring this up. Okay, Tamlin. Tamlin did not know that the King of Highburn had kidnapped Feyre's sisters and planned to change them into Fae. This shows that Tamlin might have a silver lining, as in he doesn't try to actively hurt her sisters. But let's be real, Nesta and Elaine wouldn't even be there if it wasn't for Tamlin. So why am I bringing this up? Well, remember at the beginning of the season when Rhys was having a hard time trying to get Feyre to trust him again after what he had done under the mountain? We argued that ultimately, intention doesn't matter when you're dealing with other people's trauma. It's not up to Feyre to change the narrative of her experience under the mountain to fit Rhys's truth. The fact is that Rhys made a call, and that call hurt her. He had to accept that and earn her trust again, which he eventually did. Now with Tamlin, it doesn't matter that his intent wasn't to harm her sisters. It doesn't matter that the King of Highburn did this without him knowing. Tamlin got the ball rolling. Now there are consequences for his actions. Is he going to be like Rhys and learn to own it? Or is he going to fester in his own perception of injustice? Find out next season in Book Talk for Book Talk, where we discuss A Court of Wing and Ruin 2023.
I do like that you bring up that point, because you're right. There is a very distinct parallel here between what Rhys did under the mountain and what Tamlin's done that has brought about these events for Feyre's sisters. And you have to look at it the same way.
Yeah.
That intention doesn't matter. You made choices that have a result and a consequence, and it's going to cause trauma, and you have to accept that it caused someone else trauma.
And you can't be mad at that.
Right.
Rhys gave Claire Better's name to Amarantha, and that caused Feyre trauma. It caused him trauma too, but like, there's just a lot of things that happened, and Rhys got pissy initially with Feyre, but he learned to stop being pissy very quickly.
Yes.
So will Tamlin?
I'm so excited to talk about the changing of Elaine and Nesta. This is one of the reasons I believe Elaine is a character with hidden depth and strength who is so like her sister Feyre. Before anything happens, the King of Highburn tells the queens and Feyre, quote, "A strong-willed individual could survive the change from human to fae via the cauldron." Highburn also lets us know that Ianthe pried information from Feyre about her sisters, quote, "I had told Ianthe everything about my sisters. She had asked. I had fed her every detail." As a result of Ianthe's espionage, Highburn comments with confidence that, quote, "Ianthe suggested they were both strong-willed women, like their sister. No doubt they'll survive and prove to our queens it can be done, if one has the strength." These points altogether are super important as we examine the order in which the Archeron sisters enter the cauldron. First Elaine, and then Nesta. When we think of strength among this pair, I think we always assume Nesta is the stronger one because of her attitude toward everyone. She's haughty, sometimes bitchy, and sometimes that just comes across as strength. When you think about it, it's really important that this change from human to fae goes right for the King of Highburn so that he can convince the queens to take advantage of the cauldron and ultimately get what he wants from them. Why Elaine first, then? While you could say that the king picked at random, what did Farah say about, quote, the prettier one of her sisters, so that Elaine is the one put in first? Note, when Cassian's wings get shredded, the sisters shriek over their gags, quote, but Elaine's cry, a warning. Elaine is more aware and observant, maybe just like Farah.
So I'm going to address two points that you made there, and then I'm going to make a different point that we didn't talk about. A surprise point for you.
Okay.
The King of Highburn says the pretty one, not the smaller one, the younger one, things that people might normally associate as weaker. So the king definitely knows something as well. Plus, like you mentioned, Elaine gave the warning, not Nesta. Farah wouldn't have been able to fight Tamlin if Elaine didn't give the warning. I was thinking about the SJM speaking event that happened recently, and she was reflecting on, I can't remember which book this happened, maybe you can tell me. I think it might be 3, but when Elaine and Farah go back to the old cabin that they lived in, and Farah goes back and she thinks about like how, she just thinks about like anger and, you know, all this resentment and feelings that she had there. And Elaine looks back and is kind of more like wistful with it, because when she lived there, it was a place of hope and potential. And then Farah asks herself, well, which one of us was the real strong one?
Yeah, that was book one.
That makes sense. It's book one, because Farah recognized out of Nesta, Farah, and Elaine, if Elaine's the only one who had that strength, who had that courage to have hope, you know, I think Farah respects that.
Yeah, I think so too.
Back to what we were mentioning, that Elaine warned Farah about Tamlin coming at her. And I just wanted to say that Elaine warned Farah about Tamlin coming at her. And then Farah just turns around and throws knives at Tamlin, like with all of her strength. Damn.
I love it because their first encounter, Farah and Tamlin, she held cutlery from the table, but she didn't do anything with it. And now she's throwing knives.
She's like, I've upgraded, bitch.
Yeah, that's right.
They're coming for you.
Let's talk about the fact that Tamlin decides to now resist the King of Highburn, only now that Feyre's sisters are at risk. So he's okay taking Feyre away from her mate, but doesn't want to harm her sisters. That seems a little confusing to me.
Quote, the white hot magic slammed into him, him being Tamlin, slammed into him, shoving him to the ground, leashing him. Tamlin strained against the collar of the light on his neck, around his wrists. Tamlin was leashed by Amarantha with a mask, and now he's being leashed with an actual collar. And then the King of Highburn ends up gagging him with some of the same white magic. Despite Cassian and Azriel literally bleeding out on the floor, Tamlin still manages to be the weakest one in the room because he's the animal who's being tethered. It also stings more to his pride that Farah will be the one who breaks open the enchantments and he just had to sit there and wait.
Yeah, just like he does in all other situations.
Like, think how awkward that is, though, is like no one else is tied or gagged. Not Lucien, not Rhys, just him. Like, you've been a bad little boy. You have to be tied up in the corner now. And it's like, how demeaning is that? Like, you're laying on the ground tied up.
Yeah.
And you have to keep your mouth shut.
Yeah, it's very demeaning.
Ha. Take that. Tamlin.
Karma.
Karma.
Feyre, for all her pride and strength, resorts to begging, saying please to save her sisters. But Feyre knows that word doesn't work with the queens, and please once again has become powerless as it was all throughout Thorns and Roses, and as it has been between most people in this book, except when it's said amongst the inner circle. The tragedy of this is marked by Feyre's last plea, quote, please, I said to none of them, demonstrating that even Feyre knows the word is empty again. One of the most heartbreaking moments of this chapter, in my opinion, occurs when Elaine is out of the cauldron and Nesta is being forced in. Feyre and Rhys share a look. Both of their worst nightmares have come alive just from this one event. Rhys feared being unable to fight while those he loves are hurt, and Feyre's sisters are hurt beyond repair, taken against their will. Rhys's eyes show, quote, rage and guilt and utter agony, the mirror to my own.
I want to talk about Nesta, how she points one finger at the king as she slowly goes down. I mean, not slowly, but like as she's being forced underwater. I've seen a lot of fan art with just like one hand poking out of a water pointing.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't take it seriously.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like when I read the description, It is a little unnerving, but when I look at it visually, it's like, yeah, it's a little silly.
In Alive, I tried doing that. And right now, I'm a little bit lower to the ground than you, so let me just try it.
Avada-kedavra.
But it sounds intimidating, and then as it happens, you're like,
nah.
Did she just point a finger? Like, how did she know her head was underwater?
Yeah, it is a little silly.
If I was the king, I'd just, like, take two steps to the left.
Put someone in front of you.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, was it to me?
He sounded slightly Italian. It wasn't to me.
No, sorry. Let's come back to some Lucian development. Lucian is now starting to push back, get mad, and be vocal, all for Elaine. He's stepping up in a big way for Lucian, and we find out it's because he's mates with Elaine. Let's look at who's having the most instinctive moments in this scene. Lucian is reaching out to Elaine, and mind you, he was reaching out to Elaine even before Elaine became Fae, and Cassian is reaching out to Nesta, and Az is reaching out to Mor. I don't think that Elaine and Az are mates, and I know there aren't many theories about the two of them being secret mates, but I'm going to say that I don't believe they're OTP, not because I don't like her, not because of anything else going on, but rather here on Elaine's darkest day, Azriel never reached out to her.
I kind of want to use this point to talk about the theory that Tamlin and Elaine are mates. I've seen this a lot on TikTok that people believe Lucian is covering for Tamlin. And I just don't think that when you analyze what Lucian's doing versus what Tamlin's doing, that that still holds merit.
Yeah.
Tamlin is not thinking about Elaine.
Mm-mm.
Only Lucian cares about what's happening to Elaine. And yes, Tamlin's gagged. But at some point, he just stops moving and he's not even in the picture at all.
Can we also like really appreciate the fact that Lucian did not stand up for Farrah at all in the beginning of the book and even in this whole like before Elaine and all them come out? He stays quiet. He never talks back to Tamlin. He never really pushes it. And suddenly within seconds of seeing Elaine, he's getting aggressive. And then once she turns into a Fae, he's talking and he's yelling. That is not Lucian at all. Like season one, Thorns and Roses, Lucian, yeah, he was a little sassy, but that's just because Tamlin didn't have power. And yeah, Tamlin's like gagged and bound right now, but like he was not talking back to Tamlin at all this entire scene until Elaine was in trouble.
I think you're completely right. And any resistance we see from Tamlin in this scene is not because he wants to save Elaine. It's because anything that happens to Feyre's sisters will damage Tamlin's relationship with Feyre.
Yeah, like he keeps being like, shit, no, please don't. Okay, damn it. Hey, Feyre, don't look at this.
It didn't happen. So much comes to a head in chapter 66. And like the rest of this episode, we see how things Sarah J. Maas set up earlier in the novel contribute to the choices here. Rhys attempts to make a bargain with Hybern, the only way Rhys seems to know how to solve problems. However, Feyre is not having it, and is not willing to let Rhysand sacrifice himself as he always has. This is important setup, by the way, for her and Rhys's relationship in A Court of Wings and Ruin. Instead, Feyre is willing to do what she's always done. She sacrifices herself for those she loves.
Feyre is out here willing to make moves and get shit done.
Respect. Multiple times now, Feyre has promised to destroy the Spring Court, not only here, but earlier with Lucian in the Illyrian Mountains. So it makes sense Feyre would create a situation where she would be taken there. Feyre uses her bond with Rhys to distract everyone. And she uses her growing powers to destroy the wards of the castle. This may feel a little bit like a stretch, though we've seen Feyre's powers continue to grow every time she uses them. So maybe we as readers are willing to suspend our disbelief.
Let's talk writing technique here. All fantasy writers require their readers to willingly suspend their disbelief. This is just how it works, and the good writers out there don't really have you question it too much. SJM's dancing with fire a little bit here, but you know what? I'm on board. I'll go with it.
And I think we all do. We get caught up in the momentum of what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's just, that's what a good fantasy writer does. Or, yep. Like, you don't think about it too much.
Yep. And then Feyre, quote, only had to play her part. Feyre has learned to play games and roles during her time with Rhysand. She's gone from disgust at the role Tamlin wanted her to play, to practicing her acting at the Summer Court, to enjoying her charade at the Court of Nightmares, and in front of Lucian in the Illyrian Mountains. What an amazing transformation Feyre has undergone. Feyre even thinks toward Reese, please play along. A similar thought she had about Reese when he was upset about losing Tarquin's friendship much earlier in the novel. When Reese finally gets the message, Feyre is relieved, but sad. Quote, one last game. This was one last game we were to play together. We see how the theme and Feyre's desire for home is altered here for the sake of her scheme. Feyre uses home and implies that the Spring Court is her home to help convince Tamlin to take her away. Where once home was an unknown to Feyre, a concept she longed for but didn't know how to get or make, it has now become a weapon.
Feyre has taken on a whole new role here as a spy and is already a fast learner. Quote, Feyre, Tamlin said softly, and I knew I'd won. I sobbed harder. Like, Feyre knew the second that he, like, when she had him, and so it's like, I'm gonna just sink the knife in more.
Yeah, lay it on thick.
Feyre knows that her tears can be used. She can now weaponize what was viewed as weakness, something that Tamlin easily considered weak. He didn't cry in front of her, he didn't let her and cry in front of him. It's a sign of weakness to him, so therefore it can't possibly be strong or a weapon. I want to call out one of my favorite all-time Tamlin quotes. Quote, I don't give a shit if she's your mate. I don't give a shit if you think you're entitled to her. She's mine. Kettle, pot, like what?
Yeah, seriously.
How do you not hear yourself, man? I'm just imagining like even the King of Hibern's in the corner being like, did anyone else hear that?
Stupid.
Yeah, the fact that Feyre can even have a straight face at that point is impressive. Like, I feel like I would have written, be like, and then Jack laughed in his face.
Yeah. There is a parallel at the end of this chapter that mimics Feyre's death in Thorns and Roses. As the King of Hibern uses his magic to break the bond between Feyre and Reese, Reese yells Feyre's name, and as Feyre believes she's dying, she hears a crack. Though Feyre doesn't die, the crack parallels the sound of her neck snapping when Amarantha killed her in Thorns and Roses. If you think about it, that's not the only parallel. Feyre breaks the curse in Book 1, just as she breaks the wards on the castle here in this book. Feyre's life, as she knows it, ends here, and she's forced to accept a new life as a result, just like when she was remade at the end of Thorns and Roses. Tamlin did nothing to help Feyre in either of these situations, and instead, he was the cause of the torment and pain that she felt both times.
Chapter 67 is a great chapter for Lucien. Baby Bird is starting to fly free here. I'm going to read a few quotes that show how he's changed in a short amount of time and what we can expect to see in Wing and Ruin. Quote, he snarled at Tamlin over the ranting of the king, a mate already gone wild to defend what was his. Lucien spun towards me, that metal eye whirled and narrowed. Centuries of cultivated reason clicked into place, but Lucien was watching me warily, too warily. Total side note, you and I and everyone who's on our live that we talk to, sometimes they're like, oh, Lucian's going to become High Lord. And you and I have said, like, he's not strong and he would have shown strength by now. And that's like a very big thing. Like the High Lords, like, you know who they're going to be because you see how strong they are.
Right.
What he's always been was considered clever and smart. And even when Feyre slipped into his mind at the beginning of this book, it was described as old and clever. And then now here he is as like centuries of cultivated reason clicked into place. It's funny how Lucien, a person who's obviously like someone who's smart, hasn't allowed himself to be smart because he's been friends with Tamlin.
True.
Because when I read this and I see centuries of cultivated reason clicked into place, I almost imagine that as like his brain completely turns on, not just with Feyre, but with Tamlin and everything else. And is just like, wait a minute, like he's woken up.
Yeah, like he's been submerged underwater or like tune deaf this entire time. And now that his mate is here, he's finally shaken off whatever's put this fog over his brain.
Exactly.
I do have a spoiler for Wing and Ruin.
Okay.
Lucien is Helion's son.
Yeah.
Their trove
is the library.
Is knowledge.
Yeah. Yep. So it makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. His power might be clever in reasoning.
So if he does become High Lord,
it'll be the Day Court.
Yeah, which it always would have been the Day Court.
Yeah.
But it would never be a show of strength. It would always have to be a show of reason.
Yeah, I agree.
Look at us already warming up to him.
Yeah.
Look at that.
We've demonstrated character growth.
Have we?
No, we haven't.
I think we've demonstrated character digression.
Yeah.
Just, that's what we've done. it's going to be really, really fun analyzing him for Wing and Ruin. How much of Lucien's determination to get to Elaine has to do with the natural mating instinct? Or maybe he feels like he has lost his chance of ever having love again, and now here's a mate and he's trying to hold on to that. Or maybe he feels entitled to some kind of love after experiencing all that pain. We know it's not love because he's never really met Elaine. This is the first time. You can't fall in love with someone. Just because you look into their eyes and you're like, mate, doesn't mean love. It just means like, oh shit. I mean, I don't even know what it means. It just means like, I guess we're meant to be together, but not really, because sometimes it sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean they're extra horny for each other?
I think so.
Well, good for Elaine for holding back.
Yeah.
I mean, not that hard when you got real horniness by you.
Yeah, it's true.
I just keep thinking about Asriel's pierced member.
The parallels continue in chapter 67. Once Moore and Rhys winnow away with Cassian, Asriel, Elaine, and Nesta, Feyre attempts to use her bond. Quote, there was only silence in my head, such silence where there had once been dark laughter and wicked amusement, a wind-blasted wasteland. When Feyre said goodbye to Rhys in Thorns and Roses, the mountain she stood on was also barren. Both might be indicative of the future Feyre sees for herself at the Spring Court. The queens decide to use the cauldron despite the chaos. Note that Feyre describes them as, quote, wolves circling prey. Though they seem like the ultimate predators here, it's not because of their power.
The chapter ends with Feyre telling the king that she will light the pyres herself for what he did to her sisters. And, okay, we talked about this, you and I, Amy, where, like, was she threatening him or the queens or maybe just the whole room in general, which honestly is fair. But either way, she's not threatening to kill anyone. She's threatening to light the pyres.
They'll die.
Yeah.
She doesn't care how, but she'll still be
she's
alive.
Like, I will be there and I will light it. Yeah. I think it's like a more realistic threat.
I think so too. I think so too. Chapter 68 gives us our first change in point of view in the series, something we'll see a little bit more of in A Court of Wing and Ruin. Why is this moment important? Why couldn't we have stuck with Feyre's point of view in this chapter? I think you could argue that we could get the majority of the information through Feyre's point of view. So how does this add value to the narrative and plot?
I think if we got this reveal from Feyre, it would make her look too evil. From Rhys, we understand it's a sacrifice and there is a larger plan at play. Feyre is currently in the Spring Court doing a little jig, knowing that she's about to burn the whole place down. We also need to know that they understand one another, that even though we weren't able to see Rhys and Feyre talk to each other at Highburn, they're on the same page. If this was from Feyre, we wouldn't know for sure if Rhys was in on the whole thing with her.
That's fair. That's excellent points.
Thank you.
In the second chapter of Mist and Fury, Tamlin tells Feyre there's no such thing as High Ladies. Here, in the second to last chapter, Rhys announces, quote, not consort, not wife. Feyre is High Lady of the Night Court, my equal in every way. She would wear my crown, sit on a throne beside mine, never sidelined, never designated to breeding and parties and child rearing. My queen. I want to suggest this is a literary device seen in ancient writing and scripture, not only in the Bible, but Hebrew, Arabic, and also the writing of the ancient Americas, like on the ruins of Mayan structures. I'm sure it's elsewhere too. These are just the ones I know of. The writing device is called chiasmus, or chiasm. In rhetoric, chiasmus is the reversal of grammatical structures in successive phrases or clauses. It's often used as a tool to help teach concepts and causation. The structure of a chiasmus is for a series of phrases or events to take place, and then for them to be repeated in reverse order. Though I can't necessarily say the entirety of Mist and Fury is one chiasmus, I see elements of it here in this moment when Rhys announces Feyre's status as High Lady, and when you compare it back to Tamlin's treatment of the term High Lady at the start of the book.
It's a really good point. Quote, she's my mate and my spy, I said too quietly. And she's the High Lady of the Night Court. Absolutely amazing that this book is ending the same way it started. It started with Feyre asking about High Ladies and Tamlin wanting Feyre to spy for him, even though she felt uncomfortable and didn't want to. Now Feyre is here as High Lady and as a spy. It's full circle.
I also want to note that at the start of the book, Feyre was waiting for the mating bond to snap into place.
Mm-hmm. And it snapped, baby.
It snapped.
So I also want to talk about how Rhys says at one point, Feyre didn't even feel like she was important enough to be here. And, you know, she sacrificed herself because she didn't feel like she was important enough. I don't see that in Farrah. Like, I think she became High Lady and was just like, yeah, no, I got shit to do. Yeah, I'm important.
I do have issues with this. I never got that sense either. And I have issue with this because that sentiment is going to get shoved down our throats in Wings and Ruin, just because I've been listening to the book and it keeps getting repeated.
Yeah.
But I didn't sense it here.
Not with her, because the writing didn't show that. Like, not once did Farrah hint or say, wow, I'm bringing nothing to the table right here. And I know that we're supposed to get that.
She does a couple times.
Not in the Highburn scene.
Not in the Highburn scene. What,
no, she said it throughout the book, yeah, but like she's grown out of that.
Yeah,
she has. In the Highburn scene, like, she never says that, like, wow, I'm not bringing anything to the table, because I think SJM is trying to set it up where she fails with the book so quickly, so now she's wondering, like, well, why was I even here? But she never questions that.
Yeah.
She's like, wow, I broke the spell here twice. Cassian and Az are like bleeding out. My sister's changed. No one's doing shit. Look, I know my plan may not be the best, but guess what? I got us all out of here.
Yeah, it's true.
I'm wondering if it's like, are we all supposed to confuse Farrah and like be confused with her sentiments? Or does SJM backtrack a little bit in Wing and Ruin? We'll find out next season.
Next
season. In 2023, January.
In case you forgot. When Feyre arrives at the Spring Court Manor at the beginning of Chapter 69, she thinks of the manor as she once thought of her family's cottage. Quote, still lovely, but there were the front doors he'd sealed me behind. There was the window I'd banged on, trying to get out. A pretty rose-covered prison.
And there's the cookie that I dropped. Still there. Quote, I had forgotten how quiet it was here, how small, how empty. Okay, initially I was like, is she talking about his penis?
Wow. That's harsh.
But then I was like, no, she's not. Not everyone has your brain, Jack. But I do think it's funny that she's comparing this place to Velaris and to the townhome and saying that it's small, quiet, and empty. When, if you think about it, the manor is guaranteed bigger than a townhome.
Mm-hmm.
It's not empty because it has servants and guards and everything else there, and therefore probably not as quiet as Reese's place. It's just different. It's funny.
Right. It just feels wrong to her.
Yeah. She feels so wrong that she found the wrong descriptors. So brings me back to it. She is talking about his penis.
Okay. I don't know how, but I'll take your word for it. Feyre has become Reese, and this is conveyed perfectly in her lie using truth. Quote, I thought I'd never see it, the Spring Court, again.
I love that.
We see some interesting growth from Tamlin in this final chapter. Or is it growth? Is it change? I don't know. But it sets up the dynamics we'll see in Wings and Ruin. When Feyre remarks that Tamlin freed her from Rhysand, Tamlin counters that Feyre did it herself, something I don't think Tamlin would have ever been very happy about at the start of the novel, since it's his job to do the protecting.
I don't know if Tamlin believes this or he said that because he feels like he has to. Does Tamlin think that he played a part in her freedom? I mean, yes, probably.
Yeah, it's like 80-20% ownership.
Yeah, like, you did it, sweetie. You freed yourself. It's such a, like, I don't know, because we know his mindset, it feels really demeaning.
Yeah, it feels condescending.
Yeah, like, you freed yourself. But I'm the one who went to Highburn, plotted you to get there, partnered with the king, and you know what I mean?
Right. It's like when a mom and a child make a cake. The mom does all the work, but the child puts it into the oven.
You did it, sweetie.
Yeah. You made the cake. Yay. No, you didn't.
Yeah. Feyre made the cake.
When Feyre demands to be part of things moving forward, with no shutting her out and no guards allowed, Tamlin consents. Quote, we'll start over. Do things differently. When you were gone, I realized I'd been wrong. Though it is, as Feyre describes, that it's too little too late, it is interesting that it required Feyre's absence for Tamlin to change his ways, just as we once saw with Reese at the beginning of the novel.
So let's get into the last bit of breadcrumbs for the season. Warning, breadcrumbs for all SJM works, the universe, multi-universe, everything, just breadcrumb, okay? In chapter 62, quote, perhaps the entire universe had come from it, the cauldron, which is why you shouldn't destroy it in Wing and Ruin. Farrah?
I wonder if that also includes Crescent City.
Oh, like they shouldn't destroy a cauldron?
No, the entire universe came from the cauldron.
Yeah, probably.
Maybe. In chapter 63, Jorian says to Mor, "You were always such a liar, Morrigan." Yeah, she is.
Yeah. Chapter 65, quote, "The king rose. What a mighty queen you are," he breathed to Mor. "You mean maybe a queen of the dust court, let's just say?"
Also in chapter 65, Cassian turned again, his shredded wings twitching and spraying blood, his muscles quivering. At Nesta's shouts, her raging, his eyes fluttered open, glazed and unseeing, an answer to some call in his blood, a promise he'd made to her. Nothing needs to be said except for the fact that I love these two.
Still in chapter 65, quote, "I knew that she, Nesta, was different, as if the cauldron in making her had been forced to give Mor than it wanted, as if Nesta had fought even after she went under and had decided that if she was to be dragged into hell, she was taking the cauldron with her, as if that finger she's pointed was a death promise to the king of Highburn." I mean, that setup, that's just like pure setup for
100.
Everything else. Fantastic breadcrumb slash like it's a loaf.
Yeah, it is a loaf. And last, but not least, in chapter 66, Feyre unleashes her power, a flash of that white, pure light, all that could escape with the damper from the king's spell. A flash of the light that was only for Rhys, only because of Rhys. So I want to suggest, and once again, spoiler, 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 this is showing us again that Feyre is starborn. Think about Bryce and Hunt in Crescent City, how there are stars in Bryce's eyes. Think about the finale of House of Earth and Blood, where Bryce unleashes her star light to blind everybody. Mm-hmm. Same thing's happening here.
Yeah.
And now, dear listener,
ooh,
we have gotten to the end of our finale, and we have a couple of questions to discuss. The question we asked at the beginning of this episode was, what does accountability look like for each of the characters at the end of this novel?
It looks so different. Some people are too accountable. Other people not accountable enough. I think it shows the progression and the lack of progression for each character. So you have Tamlin, who is not accountable for his actions at all. And then you have someone like Feyre, who has always been overly accountable and is now, again, surprisingly just kind of like being Mor aggressive with her choices that she's making.
To your point, Feyre's always been accountable, but what's interesting when you compare the end of Thorns and Roses to the end of Mist and Fury is how Feyre handles that accountability. At the end of Thorns and Roses and beginning of Mist and Fury, Feyre felt burdened by the accountability for the death of the fairies and breaking of the curse. She wasn't ready to bear those consequences. Whereas now, at the end of Mist and Fury, Feyre is so driven that she'll take on her accountability, she'll take on Rhys's accountability, and she knows there will be consequences, but she doesn't care. She's just like, this is the choice that has to be made, this is the best choice in this moment, and I'm going to power through and keep going. And that's a very different Feyre.
Oh yeah, totally, totally different than anything else. But I mean, like, she's been learning by a group of people who are very accountable.
Yeah, for once in her life, she's surrounded by people who are equally as accountable as she is.
She can take a break and rely on one another, on them, and rely on them having her back. I mean, let's think about earlier in this episode where Feyre kind of free falls slightly with Cassian. And there's not even a mention of a scream, not a mention of a, like, she just kind of is like, oh, I'm falling. Okay, no, he caught me.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's crazy to think about that. And that was the first time she free fell with anyone other than Rhys.
Yep.
So just the sheer trust that she has there with these people is great.
Yeah, it's intense. And beyond that, she's accountable for her failures. And that's something Tamlin is not demonstrating here. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Feyre failed with the cauldron and with the Book of Breathings. And so she does what she has to do to right the situation. And not very many people are able to do that.
It's like at work when it's like, look, we weren't able to get X, Y, and Z, but then you bring like three other solutions. Like, you never go to your boss with something bad. You always go with like, all right, well, here's the thing that happened, but here are three options on how we can fix it.
Right. Or here's what I'm doing to remedy the situation as much as possible.
Yeah. Because then it's like you're telling your boss what the new change is rather than like, I made a mistake.
Right.
It turns into, well, this is how we're pivoting.
Right. Exactly.
So we have other questions, topics that we want to quickly discuss. At the beginning of this entire season, on episode one, we looked at the themes of home in general and then what is good and bad. So I want to revisit these ideas. I think home is something that we've definitely I don't want to say it's been shoved down her throat, but it's been very obvious, very clear the entire time. The concept of good or bad was way more prominent at the beginning of this book than it was middle or end.
I think you're right, but something I noticed as we were preparing for this episode is the fact that the King of Highburn has white magic.
Mm-hmm.
What do we associate with white?
Good.
Good. Rhys has black magic.
We think that's bad.
Exactly. And what this whole book has done, I've tried really hard to point out every time there's been a contradiction associated with Feyre, Rhys and anybody, really, this book has turned the concept of good and bad on its head.
Yes.
It's turned around the concept of what we think is right for Feyre, who we think is right for Feyre. And I love that it's so intricately woven through every aspect of what SJM is writing in this novel.
You're right. I mean, it was done really, really well. Like, you start off with this book with, like, the person you think that Feyre is in love with, and with her friend being a priestess, and they have to be good. And here are all these, the truths that we know, and the truths that we know end up being different. But I think that's just, like, a general great life lesson, you know? Like, we think we know something, but the second you're willing to open your eyes a little bit, see through a different perspective, then suddenly you realize what you think you knew, you didn't know. So the concept of good and bad, it's still there. I think that we can see at the very end, like, Feyre doesn't really question that about herself anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also introduced to the King of Highburn, like you said, who has white magic, who's blandly handsome. And then here we are questioning again, like, what does it mean to be good or evil?
What's nice about this is often fantasy novels are about good versus evil. And I think that's what we're still seeing here. But good is not wholly good.
Mm-hmm. Just like Feyre and Rhys are not wholly good.
And that's okay.
Just like this podcast isn't entirely good.
But that's still okay.
But still rate us 5 stars. We did it, Amy.
We did it.
That was season 2.
Season 2. What do you think? Overall opinion of the book?
You know, it's progressed, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And when we left off with season 1 after ACOTAR, both of us walked away with a much greater appreciation with it because it was so subtle and beautiful. And with Mist and Fury, there was just so much work SJM had to do.
Yeah.
That there were things that were really obvious, really on the nose, and it lacked the subtlety of Thorns and Roses. But I'd say it wasn't until this very last couple episodes where I'm like, damn.
Yeah.
You're good, SJM.
Yeah. Yeah.
You?
I definitely was afraid going into this book that I wouldn't like it as much as I liked Thorns and Roses after we did our analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely felt concern all the way through this season.
Yep.
But as we've shown and as we've discussed, although there is so much going on and there are so many threads and so many themes, at the end of the day, SJM pays such great attention to detail, and she lays the groundwork for everything so far in advance.
Yes.
She's thorough. She's repetitive in meaningful ways.
Mm-hmm.
And the end of this novel could not be further from the beginning of the novel. And it's all believable.
Yeah. And I can't tell you when it changes. Like, that's the crazy part. Right.
Right. It's such a gradual progression. And I think at the end of the day, that's why people love this book so much. Not just because of Feyre and Rhysand's relationship, but because of where it started and where it ends.
Yeah. I mean, the book started as a breakup book, and it's not at the end of it. You know, like, Feyre doesn't really bat an eye at Tamlin. She tries to throw a knife at him. You know,
right.
Like, she's not bothered by him like that anymore.
Yeah.
And she's let certain things go. And the woman who was so broken at the beginning is just not who she is anymore. And I respect this book more than I was worried about respecting it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I was like, I too was worried. I'm like, oh God, this is a lot of, like, there's no subtlety to it, but it's also extremely subtle. And I respect it for that.
I applaud you, Sarah J. Maas.
Good job, SJM. You did it again. You got us. You zingered. You got it for a zinger, kid. So I guess next season, that's when we're going to talk about Wing and Ruin.
Yeah. I hope you guys stick around. January 2023.
January 2023, we have a new song intro.
Oh, yeah. You won't hear it until then, though.
No. It'll be a nice surprise. Thank you for listening to this season of Book Talk for Book Talk.
We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform.
We would love to hear your thoughts based on today's conversation. You can submit your comments to our form at booktalkforbooktalk.com for a chance to have your feedback discussed during a weekly mini episode.
If you are enjoying the podcast, visit our website, booktalkforbooktalk.com, to view our latest merch and to learn about supporting the show through Patreon, Ko-Fi, or Venmo.
Bye.